From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Race and the justice system. Can we talk? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama wants white Americans to understand why blacks are so angry over George Zimmerman's acquittal in the killing of Trayvon Martin. Polls show 51% of whites approve the verdict, while almost 90% of blacks disapprove. So Friday, the president got personal about stereotyping and fear. Can whites really feel the pain? Are we talking honestly about race for the first time in years? Or is the so-called national conversation all too familiar? Does it create false expectations of healing when it's really an angry debate that opens old wounds? Today's talking point are pesticides killing the bees. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Since the George Zimmerman verdict, polls show a sharp divide between blacks and whites when it comes to the justice system. President Obama has tried to explain why blacks are so angry. Will another national conversation make things better or worse? Today's talking point, the massive decline of bee populations that pollinate crops is threatening the world's food supply. Once a suspect insecticide has been banned in Europe, but not in the U.S., we'll hear why. First, this news update. The Pentagon has provided the Senate a list of options for action to intervene in Syria's increasingly bloody civil war. Committees of both houses of Congress have approved weapons shipments by the CIA. Karen DeYoung is senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be here.
When there hasn't yet even been a choice of strategies, when are we likely to see actual deployment? How much closer do these decisions by the committees of Congress move us to that?
I think the administration hopes that it can begin some weapon shipments within the next few weeks. They already have the infrastructure in place with a lot of people over there, primarily in Jordan, doing training, setting up logistics, getting intelligence capabilities in place to help the rebels. The arms shipments are just one part of this, and what they're hoping is now that they've gotten the intelligence communities to sign off, they can start these shipments, which I think no one expects to make a huge difference on the ground, other than psychologically, knowing that the United States has finally decided to get in the game of arming the rebels.
Well, now, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, provide these five options for action. Is what you've just described and what the CIA is doing implementing one of those options?
Well, again, these were options for the military, and this is a program that is being carried out by the CIA with some assistance from the military. Among the five options that General Dempsey listed, the first one more or less coincides to what the CIA will be doing. It is, again, providing training and advice, logistics, intelligence for the rebels outside of Syria, primarily in Jordan. General Dempsey estimated that this would cost about $500 million a year, but that again is if the military were to do it. I'm told that the CIA believes they can do it a lot more cheaply. The other options were escalating up to and including going after the Syrian government's chemical weapons stores. But along the way, he discussed the possibility of establishing a no-fly zone over rebel-held areas of Syria, supporting buffer zones inside Syria just over the borders from Jordan and Turkey, which would be, again, government no-go areas. But as General Dempsey described these, it was a very complicated, expensive proposition in all cases, which he said would cost more than $1 billion a month in each of those two latter cases, even more than that, to do something about the chemical weapons, involve ships, airplanes, troops, again, not in Syria, but right on the border of Syria.
Now, in the Congress, there seems to be quite a dispute. On one side, there are those who say that what's being proposed isn't enough, and on the other, that none of the plans have any real possibility of removing rulers of Syria, and that we don't want to get entangled in another civil war.
I think that a lot of attention has been paid to people like Senator McCain, who's been quite vocal in calling for a step up of U.S. effort there, calling for a no-fly zone, calling for U.S. air attacks against the Syrian Air Force. And the vocalness of people who want more, I think, has kind of overshadowed what is a pretty large number who don't want to do anything. There are a number of people in Congress and certainly on the intelligence committees who had to consider this CIA program who think that this is a slippery slope to greater U.S. involvement, who don't see any real promise that this is going to work, who think that the administration doesn't have a comprehensive long-term plan. And if you look at public opinion polls, most people in this country, according to these surveys at least, tend to agree with them and don't want to get involved.
So they don't want to see involvement in another civil war, especially if it's going to cost billions of dollars a month and not be very effective.
Exactly.
In the meantime, what do we know at the moment about President Assad and his retinue? Are they still in Damascus, and how are they doing with regard to fighting off the rebels?
Well, they're definitely still in Damascus. This has kind of been an up and down war where in early spring the rebels seemed to be doing quite well. And it was one of those occasions of which we've seen a number over the past 2 years where the general thinking was that Assad was going to go sooner rather than later. That has sort of flipped now. The government forces have been pushing the rebels back in a number of places, ostensibly because they're being given more aid and more militia assistance from Iran and from Hezbollah. Again, it looks like Assad's on top now. I was looking at Lakhdar Brahimi, who is the UN special representative for Syria here in Washington on Monday, and sort of discounted this kind of up and down, talking about how it's something that you never can really judge.
Karen DeYoung, senior diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post, many thanks as always.
You're welcome.
In a moment, race in the justice system. Can we talk? On To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The racial gap is overwhelmingly clear. Just over 50% of whites approve the not guilty verdict in George Zimmerman's killing of Trayvon Martin. Almost 90% of blacks disapprove. So what are the chances of achieving a national consensus when it comes to the justice system and race? Jason Silverstein has written about what he calls the racial empathy gap. He's a PhD candidate in anthropology at Harvard. His articles appear in Slate and The Atlantic magazine. Jason Silverstein, good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
We know about the gap in the polls. What is the racial empathy gap?
Well, what the racial empathy gap is basically this growing literature that shows that all people tend to assume that black people feel less pain than white people. This has been done experimentally, and you can imagine all the different social problems that it helps explain. Two areas that I've talked about have been healthcare and the criminal justice system, in that if in healthcare, if we don't think that black people feel as much pain as white people, you can imagine that they will get less pain medicine when they need it the most, and we've seen that over and over again. We've also seen this in the criminal justice system, and we know that race and empathy impact jury decisions. Overall, I think the message becomes that black defendants tend to receive harsher sentences, and black life tends to be, and black pain tends to be undervalued.
How do you measure this issue of empathy?
Well, it's very interesting. What researchers have done, and this has been conducted from labs in Italy to labs in the University of Virginia, is to say, look, empathy on a physiological level sort of works like this. If you and I are walking down the street and I trip and fall and hurt my knee, if you watch this, your brain will light up in the same way as if you had tripped and hurt your knee. And this is a really interesting mirroring thing that happens. But it turns out that if we show participants images of black people and white people experiencing that same accident, all people will assume that the pain experienced by black people will be less than the pain experienced by white people.
When you say all people, does that include black people?
It does. This is what was a very surprising result. So what researchers in the University of Virginia saw was that it was white people, it was black people. It was also nurses and nursing students, who are obviously some of our most compassionate people. And what they decided was that this couldn't be just because of racial animosity. Something else has to be going on here. And when they pressed on it, what they found was that assumptions about what it means to be black in terms of social status and hardship may actually be what's behind the bias. And it turned out that the participants assumed that black people felt less pain because they assumed they had been hardened by life so they could take more pain. So you can see how this shows how this creates this cycle of pain, right? Because there's this belief that black people are already hardened by racism, then there's this people tend to believe that black people are less sensitive to pain and then are forced to endure more pain.
What have you heard from the George Zimmerman jurors that would bolster your case?
Well, you know, I think that it was at least in the first interview that I think has been widely discussed with Anderson Cooper. We hear from a juror about, you know, where she is clearly empathizing more with, you know, George Zimmerman, calling him by name, talking about how he had a good heart. And yet we did not hear much about this young 17-year-old who clearly, you know, had been profiled and had been at the very least misperceived as dangerous, which I think is part of this empathy gap. That seems to, I think, go right into the president's remarks and trying to pull us into seeing the perspective of someone not only like himself, but like Trayvon Martin and like many juveniles in the juvenile justice system who are misperceived as being more dangerous than they actually are.
Jason Silverstein again, writing for Slate in the Atlantic, PhD student in anthropology at Harvard University. Let's hear a bit about what the president said in Friday's comments about the Trayvon Martin case. He raised the prospect of a national conversation of the kind that so many politicians have called for when issues seem almost impossible to resolve.
I haven't seen that be particularly productive when, you know, politicians try to organize conversations. They end up being stilted and politicized, and folks are locked into the positions they already have. On the other hand, in families and churches and workplaces, there's the possibility that people are a little bit more honest, and at least you ask yourself your own questions about, am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can?
Daniel Menaker is a former editor of The New Yorker magazine. He's author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Are we having a national conversation? The president says they don't work. He calls for something different, which sounds pretty much the same, with the family members, churches, workplaces being, as he suggested, more honest.
You know, I hadn't heard that part of the president's quote before this minute, I'm embarrassed to say. And I think it's very admirable, and I agree with him. I think that the term national conversation has become hackneyed and a cliche, and I think it also, as he said, doesn't really represent what happens when these issues are discussed in political forums. You very seldom hear any politician ask questions, which is one of the things that you do in a conversation. It's almost the definition of a conversation. It's also a euphemism. I mean, in a way, a national conversation on a political level, campaign level, often consists of rhetoric and a sort of disputatious, argumentative kind of posture. And so I think it's kind of what we're really having, according to the poll you cited at the beginning, and according to the way people's attitudes have been formulated since the verdict and well before that, is a national argument. It's a national dispute. At the very best, it's a national discussion. But it's not a conversation, not by the common terms of going out and having dinner and having conversation with your friends. It's people taking positions, taking postures, and arguing with each other. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, because this is the way maybe laws get passed and so on. The real conversation, I think he's quite right. It takes place among, in this particular matter, I think real conversation will take place on a more local, informal, and congenial level. And I think it will also take place when people perhaps try to stop delivering simply their own positions and opinions and start asking questions of the other people. Why do you believe this? What do you think? They can't be rhetorical questions. They have to be real questions. Where do your attitudes come from? I'll tell you where mine come from. You tell me where yours do. Maybe we're starting from old notions that need to be falsified, that need to be disproven. Maybe we're both making assumptions we shouldn't make. And if you have that kind of exchange, it's very difficult to do, with all due respect to, let's say, a radio talk show or meet the press. It's much easier to do in the more informal sort of venues that the president mentioned. I hadn't heard that before. I think it's very smart.
Again, Daniel Menaker is author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of a Conversation. Here's more from the president's comments on Friday.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator.
So, Daniel Menaker, the president obviously is speaking from the bully pulpit. He's not speaking on a conversational basis in the way that you have defined it. But do you think that that comment is helpful?
I do. I think I do. I mean, it depends on the receptivity of the people who are hearing that comment. If you are hidebound into certain positions on matters, let's say, of gun law, or if you are completely and irreversibly racist, it doesn't matter what he says. But I think that, according to Mr. Silverstein, that's the kind of remark that is a little bit more conversational. He's kind of giving witness a testimony, say, see how this is how it feels. Now, unfortunately, you know, or, well, of course, by definition, we can't answer back. But I say, well, I sort of knew that, but it's interesting to hear anyone, president or anyone else, say, how would it feel for you to have, if you got into an elevator, to have a woman clutch her purse more closely to her body just because of the color of your skin? I mean, it's still rhetoric, it's still a speech, but it seems to me on a much more personal, individual level, and that part of the speech I had heard before, and I found it impressive. But, you know, in a way, you have to go back to what he said at first, which is that these conversations have to start from the bottom up. They can't really start from the top down. What can start from the top down, possibly, is changes in laws. But changes in laws don't produce changes in personalities.
Back to Jason Silverstein, again, a PhD student in anthropology, who told us about a different kind of gap than the one we see in the polls, the empathy gap. You said that was physiological. Does it matter what anybody says?
Oh, I think so. You know, I think that the question has to come up that, look, is there any hope here? If we know that a lack of empathy might cause many social problems, does that mean that we can help make people care? And I think that one of the ways that we have seen that helps is when we do this sort of autobiographical memory sharing, right? Or, you know, in easier terms, talking about that time that you were, you know, that you were profiled, an experience I, as a white male, haven't had, and I can sit here and I can listen and try to learn more. We have seen research about this, that if we can talk to physicians, for example, about doing more perspective taking, it actually closes the pain management disparities significantly by about 55%. The one caution is that we need to make sure that the perspective we're taking isn't a perspective that comes from our own biases about how we think people react, because we know that when we stereotype people's lives, we do a really bad job of taking care of them.
Joe Hicks is former director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Los Angeles. He was head of the city's Civil Rights Commission at one point. He's now vice president of Community Advocates. That's a nonprofit that is seeking improvement in race relations. Joe Hicks, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren, as always.
How do you feel about what the president had to say? Do you feel that it was a helpful statement?
Well, you know, listening to Daniel said, I agree that in the main it did allow, and his sort of personal kind of reflections, you know, did allow, as you indicated, kind of a more conversational kind of way, you know. And he made an argument that we certainly hear a lot in the black community about people being, quote-unquote, profiled. But on the other hand, you know, he buys in with those comments, he bought into a racial version of the sort of national narrative on race that I don't think really helped very much. He simply empathized with people. And basically, if you read the code words through which he was speaking, he was basically saying, yeah, white folks got to listen to what black people are saying. They need to feel the pain, understand the pain, that sort of thing. At least that's the way it got interpreted among many black pundits who have made similar kinds of comments. So on the one hand, I thought it was a clever speech. It was a skillfully prepared speech. Obviously, these comments were somewhat off the cuff. Whether or not it will spur what we're talking about here in terms of more honest kind of dialogue, because one has to say, see, there has to be pushback in terms of what the president said. Is that largely racial mythology, or in contemporary America, how often does it happen? How prevalent is it? When a woman is in an elevator with a man who's black and by herself, what is that fear driven by? Would she be equally fearful if she was standing with a white guy all by herself in an elevator? So we have to ask a lot of questions, begin to parse this stuff out, because otherwise it becomes part of a very debilitating sort of racial narrative of victimization, and that ain't helpful at all.
Have you been profiled in the way that the president and other black people have described?
I have not personally experienced that. I've experienced other kinds of things that I would consider to be some form of you know, of that. You know, I was a younger man, and I would get stopped at odd times, and there may have or may not have been racial overtones of that. I know I always, spoke with respect to officers, didn't challenge them, didn't say and do silly and stupid kinds of things. But I have not experienced that kind of thing, but I'm kind of one of these people. I get an elevator, I don't really, frankly, pay a whole lot of attention to what someone else's reaction to me is, and I certainly have never crossed the street and heard people locking their cars. And I've been in some interesting parts of the city. I've lived here my whole life, so I'm not saying it never happens. I'm not invalidating the president's observation, but there are people who will make these comments who have never experienced it, yet it gets passed along in the narrative.
Joe Hicks, again, Vice President of Community Advocates in Los Angeles, nonprofit organization seeking improvement in race relations in this city and elsewhere around the country. We're going to take a very brief break, and then we'll continue this conversation, and we'll hear from somebody who thinks it is time to have a national conversation. Today's Talking Point, are pesticides killing the bees? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Foreman, only back with To the Point. Can we have a national conversation about race and the justice system, or is that a hackneyed idea, a cliche that really ends up invariably in a disputation rather than a conversation in the accepted sense of that term, where people don't try to share their views, perhaps even change their views, but instead get harder in their views than they were at the beginning? Aura Bogado is news editor and reporter for Colorlines.com and a contributor to The Nation magazine. It's good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What's your take on the idea of a national conversation? Do you think that is a goal that is worthy of our efforts?
I think that it's long overdue. I think that a good way to sort of think about the way that we should be having this conversation is what underlies it. It's really a matter of life and death. And I think that not talking about race at this time in particular means that we have a certain complacency, a large degree of complacency, really, with this idea that some people can be killed because of the color of their skin and with impunity. And when we think about it in that way and think about that problem and how to work towards a solution, I think that it's also helpful to start naming what things are. You played clips from President Obama's speech on Friday. During those statements, he said the word black or African-American 17 times, and he only used the word white once. And I think that's because sometimes it rubs white people the wrong way to be reminded that they're white, although it remains a fact. But I think that whiteness remains part of this problem that cannot be named. And so if we're thinking of moving forward towards a solution with the vast disparities that we see among race in so many sectors, and again, when it comes to life and death, we really need to start being able to name these parts of the problems, and whiteness in particular.
What do you mean by the problem that cannot be named?
Well, I think that a lot of times, you know, when we listen back to Obama's speech, again, he talked a lot of times was explaining to white people black people's reaction and responses to the verdict. And he was able to say black and African American so many times. We hear people of color, we hear Latinos, we hear Asians, we hear Native Americans, but we don't hear about whiteness all that often. I think that the last week and a half has provided an opportunity in order to start having a conversation about that. But it remains almost a taboo word, although it is a fact that people do live in white bodies and their experiences are shaped by that.
What should we be saying about whiteness?
You know, I think that there's a certain degree of caution. I think that people are scared that it's a kind of finger waving. And I think that white people need to come to terms with the fact that people of color have long been on the receiving end of this kind of scolding for far too long, and often for problems that are really not of their making. And I think people of color can sympathize with that idea that there's, you know, possible finger waving. And I think that a lot of times white people who already feel an affront, again, from even being called white to begin with, then try to defend themselves by saying, well, why should I feel sorry for something that my ancestors did, for example? But I think that that's really asking the wrong question. I think a better question centers on benefits and really the unearned benefits and unequal benefits that white people have acquired. So first and foremost, not having to worry about each time that they leave their homes, whether or not that they will be killed because of their skin color with impunity.
Aura Bogado again with Colorlines.com and The Nation magazine. Joe Hicks, back to you with community advocates in Los Angeles. Is that helpful? Does that advance the understanding, do you think, of people?
No. And this is the difficulty. You know, we hear some very entrenched kind of positions being stated by your guest. And so how do you have a dialogue about that? Because when you assert a reality and then either expect people to listen and be informed by that or to be repelled by it, that doesn't encourage dialogue. Dialogue means sincerely listening to what other people's views and opinions are from their perspective, even if it is, as you just said, in a white skin. And they need because they have as large a stake in this nation and the race relations of this nation as do black folks. So it's not about wagging fingers and asserting your rightness, as I think we've seen quite visibly recently. And that's the problem with this notion of a dialogue. I think many black activists see this as a chance to instruct, inform, and correct white people in their behaviors. If nothing else, just yell at them because they're angry. And there's a lot of history here. Eric Holder, of course, called for a national dialogue and said, you know, America's a nation of cowards, going all the way back to Bill Clinton, 1997. Clinton called for a national discussion, I think it was, and a project on race that he launched and impaneled a group of significant Americans to involve themselves in that project, and absolutely nothing came of it. This notion of dialogues have been around for a long time, and because politically it's not seen as open and honest and a chance to hear what other people hear and think about this country we live in, then it will go absolutely nowhere. And I don't think there is really a serious concept of a dialogue on race, because I don't think many people really sincerely want that, at least from the activist core.
What about the idea that whites do have unearned benefits, as Otto Borgado suggested, as opposed to blacks, given the history of the country, slavery and Jim Crow?
Well, that's, of course, a very controversial concept that's ingrained in left thinking and left black thinking in particular, and I know it very well because I used to be a black nationalist and a Marxist. This is ground that I'm quite familiar with, and it asserts a certain kind of thing. That white people are put in a certain kind of box and then analyzed through this sort of black left view of them and what they need to do to make the world right. And again, this hardly lends, first of all, is that credible and true about quote-unquote white America? And secondly, how do you then ever reach some kind of racial peace and harmony if, in fact, activists and civil rights leaders continue to push that particular perspective? I simply think it's unhealthy.
Otto Borgado, back to you. How do you respond to what we heard from Joe Hicks?
Well, I think that Daniel Miniker's comments earlier about the idea that maybe this isn't a dialogue and that maybe it is an argument go a long way right now. That's okay. Maybe we start at an argument. This is certainly not the time to shut down arguments or dialogues or conversations that are happening in social media spaces, at local liquor stores, at family dinner tables, only because it's a difficult conversation to have. And I think that the degree to which that's difficult depends on what kind of people we're talking about. I think that for people of color and for black folks in particular in the last week and a half, they've been having these conversations about race that echo the conversations that they often have to have as a result of living in the United States of America, and that white folks, it's not that I think they even have to shun it most of the time, but they live in a certain privileged position in which they don't have to have those conversations. So if we're thinking about trying to reach some kind of consensus, I'm not saying that we necessarily will, but we're definitely not taking any steps forward if we just want to shut down the conversation and say, well, it's too hard to have and it's going to make people uncomfortable. What's uncomfortable is the fact that for young black men in particular who walk outside of their doors, and for their mothers and for their families who don't know if that's the day that they're going to be killed because of their skin color, I think that that's a difficult conversation to have, and I think that white folks do need to sort of come to the table and be willing to have these difficult conversations.
Joe Hicks, you have argued that black people are in greater danger from other black people than they are from whites.
Well, see, this is what's so dishonest about it. I think, you know, the color lines guest is, I think, right here. I think this perhaps does start an argument because there are very different views of this. She talked about black folks leaving their homes every day not knowing whether they will be killed. I'm assuming she's, in this context, talking about white Americans or perhaps somebody who might vaguely look like George Zimmerman. That is just simply factually incorrect. 55% of shooting homicide victims in 2010 were black, yet they're only 13% of the population, and, you know, most of them are are, frankly, young black people. So, frankly, black folks in America, particularly young black men, have more to fear from others that look like them than somebody who looks like George Zimmerman. So that has to be part of this conversation. And for people to ignore that and then point the fingers constantly at white America is somehow, I think, a bit disingenuous.
Ara Bogata?
Well, you know, if we're throwing out statistics about who kills whom, we need to realize that nearly 90% of white people are killed by other white people. So that also needs to be part of the conversation. I know that conservative commentators have, you know, been very loud in saying, well, why aren't we having a conversation about black-on-black crime? The fact is that we have that conversation all the time. Anyone who's listening to this program will know that term, black-on-black crime, yet there isn't really such a term called white-on-white crime. You can understand what I mean when I say it, but it's not a term that's familiar to us at all. And yes, there are conversations, ongoing conversations about black-on-black crime. This conversation, however, is about the kind of profiling that happens by the kind of profiling that happens specifically based on race against black folks.
Let me go back to Daniel Menaker from our earlier part of our program, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation, former editor for The New Yorker and for Random House Publishing. Are we having a conversation here or not?
I'm thinking. I remember once I was in trouble with a lawyer, and I asked him a question, and it was something about a piece I'd written, and I asked him a question, and he sat there, and I said, because, you know, and I started to say something else, and he raised his finger, and he said, I'm actually thinking.
So,
and I learned a huge amount from that. And when you asked me that question about what's going on right now, right here,
mm-hmm.
You know, I actually would need to think about it a little bit. I think if the four or five of us were in a room, we could have a really good conversation. Please don't take this amiss. I think this is content for a radio show, and I think we're sort of all presenting, including me, our sort of positions on matters of what does dialogue mean and so on. I'd love to meet these people. They sound fascinating. But the kind of conversation I would have with them is, quite honestly, not the kind of thing we're doing. The kind of thing we're doing, I think, is helpful. I'm particularly interested in the last two people and the kind of opposite ways they're talking. I loved it. I'm sorry, the woman's name is
Ara Bogata.
Yeah, I liked about the conversations in local liquor stores. I personally have not had a conversation in a local liquor store. Maybe she meant bar. But when I go into a liquor store, I buy my bad white wine and basically get out as quick as I can. You know, I really think that we all want the same thing. We all wish that these reactions, responses, and reflexes would go away. It seems to me very unlikely that everyone is going to be able to get rid of their prejudices, their biases, and so on. But I think we can make improvements. And the first thing I would say, I'd say two more things. One, look at who is the president of the United States. If anybody doesn't understand how huge the factor of his presence in the White House is, then they're crazy. The second thing I would say is this is going to take time. And it's going to take a lot of intermarriage, and it's going to take, this is the place to do it, America. It's going to evolve. It's going to take its time. People are going to divest themselves of their attitudes that they have, or they're not. The people who are hidebound and stone anchored into their positions are, I think, becoming more and more isolated. I hope so. It's harder and harder to disregard the variation and the variegation of race in this country. I just talked to a guy named Lucian Rothschild. He is a half Thai, half Hungarian Jew who I had no idea. He has a sort of Asian look, but it was so invigorating. He has a British accent, for God's sake. It was so invigorating to talk to him. I had no idea where he was from. He was just a fascinating guy. And the last thing I'll say, this is going to be three instead of two. Bullworth, the movie, Warren Beatty. There's a point at which he's drunk. He's running for president or senator or something, and he says, I'll tell you how we're going to change the nation. He doesn't say marry. He says something else. Everyone's going to blank everyone else until everyone's sort of the same color. Then we'll be okay.
Ada Bogado, back to you. Do you think that if you and Joe Hicks were meeting in the liquor store or the bar or wherever, some other place, that you would have a different kind of exchange than the one we've heard on the radio?
I would hope that we would. I would love to invite him to a drink the next time I'm in Los Angeles. I do think that these kinds of conversations are crucial right now, and I hope that they don't go away. And to respond to the very last comment that Daniel Menaker just made, I think that it's too late to wait until we have this sort of post-racial society in 2050, until people of color are the majority everywhere. I think that it's a problem if we accept that in 2013, some people can walk down the street and be killed because of the way that they look, because of their skin color.
Joe Hicks, would the conversation be different, using that word again, if in fact it really were a conversation rather than a debate on a radio show between you and Ada Bogado?
Oh, I think it would be obviously a bit more casual and not as structured as this, and I'd sure take her up on that offer for a drink. I think it'd be great and great fun. I'm sure we'd have great conversation. I'd even buy. And I'd actually like to have Daniel in that conversation. I really like some of the things that he said. I think, you know, what I guess I'm saying is this kind of structure thing where you're going to structure a national conversation on race that's never going to happen, that will ever be effective in terms of dealing with the kinds of really deep polarization around ideology that I think has grown up. And in particularly troubling is this narrative of black victimization that has continued to infect this discussion. And the black movement and black leaders and black activists have never taken the time to review that and say what's accurate about that and what isn't accurate and how do we need to change that narrative, if in fact it needs to be changed, to reflect a whole host of things that have taken place in this country, including the election of a black man as the president of a nation that isn't that far away from Jim Crow laws and people being prevented from voting. So I think, like the president said, we have to take stock of, you know, the change that has taken place. We're not a perfect union, but we're on our way to hopefully being a more perfect union.
Ada Bogado, we're basically out of time, but let me ask you to respond to that, if you will. And how significant is it that we have now, for the first time, a slave-owning nation or a history of slavery, Jim Crow, and segregation, a black president?
I don't want to discount the significance of that, that he's even serving a second term in a nation with the history like the United States. It is it is still remarkable. However, I think that is not the case for most black men in the United States of America.
Okay.
Obama concluded his remarks the other day with talking about the way that his daughters interact. And again, most black schoolgirls in the United States of America aren't running around with special service detail behind them. It is remarkable, but we still need to remember everyday people.
All right. Whether it's been a conversation or a debate or something else, I want to thank all of you very much for being with us. Ada Bogado again at colorlines.com and The Nation magazine. Joe Hicks at Community Advocates in Los Angeles. Daniel Menaker, a good talk, the story and skill of conversation, former editor of The New Yorker and Random House Publishing. And our earlier guest, didn't get him in the second half, Jason Silverstein with Slate and The Atlantic, PhD student in anthropology at Harvard, who talked about the empathy gap and the difficulty of overcoming it. Thanks so much for being on our program. Without bees to pollinate crops, there would be an immediate food crisis. But so-called bee colony collapse disorder continues to kill bees in alarming numbers. Now, two Democratic congressmen want legislation to limit the use of certain pesticides before it's too late. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're on Alnebach with today's talking point. Controversy is raging over the most commonly used insecticides in the world, neonicotinoids. The European Union has suspended their use because of research that shows they could be responsible for the alarming increase in the killing of bees by colony collapse disorder. But U.S. rules about regulations are different from those in Europe, and there is disagreement about the certainty of the scientific conclusions. Colin O'Neill is Director of Government Affairs at the Center for Food Safety. Thanks very much for joining our program.
Thank you, Warren, for having me.
I take it that you are supportive of the idea of John Conyers of Michigan or Blumenauer of Oregon. Two Democrats have said that it's time not to stop using neonicotinoids until we know the truth.
Yes, we certainly are. As you pointed out, over the past decade, there's been an alarming decline in honeybee populations around the world, a phenomenon referred to as colony collapse disorder. And while a number of factors plague bee health, scientists attribute the indiscriminate use of this systemic class of insecticides called neonicotinoids to be the chief cause for honeybee deaths.
How solid is the science?
Well, the science is quite strong, neonicotinoids have been demonstrated to be highly toxic to honeybees and other pollinators. They're systemic, which means that they're taken up by the plant's vascular system and expressed through the pollen and nectar, which bees forage. They're extremely persistent in the environment and can accumulate quickly and last for long periods of time in soil and water. But they're particularly dangerous because, in addition to being acutely toxic, their exposures have very sublethal effects, things like impaired foraging and feeding behavior, disorientation, weakened immunity, and delayed larval development.
On the other hand, here's Kim Kaplan, a spokesperson for the United States Department of Agriculture Research Service, says pesticides, including neonicotinoids, are critical to food production. Crop yields would be substantially lower if we didn't use those pesticides. We have a lot of people this food feed, she says. So who goes without?
Well, you know, this issue of pesticides are needed, the chemical industry and increasingly our agencies say that we need these pesticides to survive, but one in three bites of food is reliant on honeybee pollination. So threats to pollinators concern our entire food system. Pollination services, as far as global agriculture production goes, is valued at over $125 billion. We often don't hear that side of the story.
Would there be alternatives if the neonicotinoids were no longer used? You may not be an expert in that area. I may be talking to the wrong person, but I have to raise the question.
Well, yes. Neonicotinoids are not used in all of agriculture. But the problem is that whereas farmers used to at one point apply pesticides in very targeted manners to control pests, these neonicotinoids are actually used as seed treatments, and so they're coated on almost all major seeds that farmers plant. So they're ubiquitous in the environment, and because of their systemic nature, they're persistent. And that means that bees are being exposed to loads and loads of these toxic pesticides.
How long have the neonicotinoids being banned in Europe? And do we have, as a result, any evidence as yet of whether that helped with regard to the bee deaths?
Well, that 2-year moratorium was passed in April of 2013, comes into effect around now, but is still too early to tell. Unfortunately, because of the systemic and persistent nature, bees will still be exposed to these neonicotinoids even after that ban takes place, which is why the Conyers and Blumenauer bill is really the model to be looking at.
What does it say? What does it provide?
It essentially says that EPA should look first before it leaps. In 2003, EPA granted a conditional registration to one of the neonicotinoids called clothianidin without a required field study, but on the condition that that study would be met or would be performed. That requirement has still never been met by the EPA. We still don't have that field study, and there are numerous data gaps for other neonics on the marketplace. We feel that EPA has allowed these pesticides on the market without the adequate data and science to prove that they're not harmful.
Well, would the Conyers Blumenauer bill actually ban them or simply make them cause for further study?
This is not a banned bill. The Conyers Bluminera bill rather suspends the use of these neonics on bee attractive crops and trees, those crops that bees would be exposed to these neonics on. Certain other residential uses would be allowed. However, it ensures that, those bees that are already suffering do not suffer until EPA finds that the uses of these pesticides are either safe or that certain uses could be deemed safe. It also requires field studies and would require any new insecticides that could harm bees or other pollinators like bats or birds to also be more strictly regulated before they're allowed on the market.
We've talked to scientists who weren't able to be on our program who have said that there are other issues involved here. The way bees are managed, for example, the presence of parasites. Should there also be legislation requiring that the EPA look at those?
Well, as I mentioned, there are factors, a number of factors that plague bee health, but the indiscriminate use of these systemic pesticides has been demonstrated to show weakened immunity to issues like bacteria, viruses, and mites. And we need to address all of those factors. However, the chief factor among them is the indiscriminate use of these insecticides.
We all probably think we know what bees do, but why don't you elaborate a bit on it? How important are they to the food system and why?
Well, as I mentioned, one in three bites of food is reliant on honeybee pollination. These are crops like cherries, almonds, apples. You see them in your garden as well, and come in the form of not just honeybees, but also birds.
How do the bees do that? Okay, how does the pollinization occur?
Well, bees go out into a crop. They forage on the pollen from a plant, taking it from many flowers to another. This is the basic reproductive process for plants because, whether they like it or not, they're rooted in the ground and they can't go out and spread pollen. Bees are their ally in this form of reproduction.
And there's no way we can supplant the bees or replace them in some technological way?
Unfortunately, the only option, and what we've seen in China as a result of massive bee declines, is that laborers are now hand-pollinating crops because they have lost so many bees as a result of neonicotinoids.
And is that true in China? Are they using the pesticide?
They're using the pesticides. These are the most widely used insecticides in the world, and their use has been targeted to bee declines around the world.
Okay. All right. It's an ongoing conversation. We will try to follow it. Colin O'Neill, Director of Government Affairs at the Center for Food Safety, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Should have said debate rather than conversation. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.